Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. That's a podcast part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Alfred Martin, who is going to be talking about The Generic Closet, Black Gayness, and the Black Cast sitcom. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
And thank you for writing such a fascinating book, which makes contributions, I think, across media studies, obviously contributions to literature on sexuality, on gender, but is also, I think, a really important statement, perhaps for, you know, kind of progressive politics and certainly for social justice, both in the States and also kind of more widely, given the kind of global nature of contemporary media. And I suppose the place to start with the book is its title, actually. And I'm intrigued by its title for a variety of reasons. And it would be good to hear a bit about what this kind of generic closet is. And I suppose, you know, how you chose that term and where your writing on the generic closet has come from.
So I initially began the project, as most folks do, for the first book, as the dissertation project. And in the dissertation project, I just sort of, for some reason, I came up with the term the generic closet, and I didn't really even do anything with respect to trying to theorize it. I mostly, at the time, in the States at least, you know, we were still thinking that R. Kelly was an okay thing, and he had this sort of short set of videos that was called Trapped in the Closet. And in some ways, it explored notions of race and sexuality. And so I initially wanted to just kind of play on that as a title. And then when I came to the book, and as I had been doing other writing, I came to the idea of the generic closet as a way to think about a couple of things. And one is the sort of narratology of sitcoms, generally speaking. So the idea that there is, in fact, a three-act structure around around storytelling generally, but particularly sitcoms, because they are always so concerned with returning to stasis. So partly the generic closet is about this narratology and this three-act structure, which I theorize as the first stage as detecting, the second stage as discovery, the third act as discarding. And so thinking about it as this way of thinking about shaping stories about Black gay characters within the Black cast sitcom. And then secondly, the generic closet, aside from its narratology, because of course I wanted to ask, why is there a narratology and why is there this three-act structure that I can, as a researcher, observe? I was interested in the way that the generic closet also speaks about an imagination of Black cast sitcom audiences. And so thinking about the ways that the generic closet functions as a way to understand the media industry's perhaps misplaced understanding of the anti-gay nature of Black audiences. And so that's generally where I ended up taking the term the generic closet. And so it is at turns about Black gayness, and it is also about Blackness writ large and Black audiences.
You've picked up on a couple of things that really fascinated me within the book. As you say, the kind of assumptions about what audiences want, what, you know, prejudices audiences might hold, how, you know, particular groups have to be constructed for audiences to find them kind of, you know, palatable, is really interesting. And it speaks actually to the book's combination of, I think, a kind of a political economy of television, close reading of particular sitcoms and episodes, and some audience reception studies. And we'll kind of do all three of those in turn, I think. But before then, it's probably worth doing another little bit of scene setting, which is about the object of study. And you mentioned sitcoms and the Black cast. Sitcom is the subject of the book. And this is a very kind of specific elements of the book study, and it's important, I think, to differentiate between, you know, kind of sitcoms in general and your study on the Black cast sitcom. So, you know, we're not talking here about I suppose things like, you know, Will and Grace or Friends, you know, these sitcoms that saw very, you know, perhaps narrow representations of gay masculinity during the 90s and into the noughties. We're talking about a very specific part of the sitcom genre. And it'd be good to kind of unpack the Black cast sitcom before we get into the, you know, the kind of key points of the book.
So, you know, so on one hand, I was interested in sort of thinking about what is a Black sitcom, or what is a Black cast sitcom? And so I was interested in some ways looking at, like, what are the optics of the thing in front of us? And so what does it mean for us to see a preponderance of Black folks on screen in a television comedy? And then what does it mean that, you know, as sitcoms have allegedly gotten, or I would argue television comedies have gotten more sophisticated, they've gotten rid of the laugh track and have instead gone to, you know, what is erroneously called a single cam model versus a three cam model. So I was really interested in this sort of three cam sitcom model because in some ways, I would argue it had become such an important part of television, both in the United States, but also in terms of what was exported to global markets in terms of Black entertainment. And so I was interested in thinking about, you know, as you mentioned, why we could have a Will and Grace in 1998, or why we could have an Ellen Morgan / Ellen DeGeneres coming out in 1997, and even why we could have a Black gay character on Spin City on a multicultural cast show, and I think I said Spin City already, but why we could have those things that were presumably targeted toward white audiences, and why we couldn't have that for Black audiences. And in some ways, that is the central question or the central thing that I wanted to work through in the book and that I hope I work through in the book is thinking about, before we even get to what we can see on the screen, thinking about what kinds of logics function that get us the thing before we can even see it. And that's what I was interested in.
And that's exactly what the book does so well, I think. And it comes in two ways, sort of at the front end of the book. In the first instance, you've got, I think I called it, you know, political economy of Black television, but, you know, the kind of broader question about how Black television is funded, about how the television networks have kind of come into being, the extent to which they're kind of secure or precarious, which then in turn shapes the imagination of the audience. But also you've got the kind of industrial production perspective when we're thinking about writers' rooms and how the kind of industrial constraints on writers function. And maybe we'll do those in turn. So what's the kind of story of Black television generally, and why is it that, you know, the kind of the way Black television is kind of economically organized shapes and influences these quite narrow representations of Black gay men?
So at a sort of fundamental level, I am thinking about sort of the ways that Black audiences, generally speaking, are understood as being a sort of extra audience. And what I mean by being an extra audience is this idea that Black audiences tend to be devalued, which means that, for instance, like just at a base level, if we're talking about commercial television, if advertisers want to reach 18 to 34 year old Black viewers with, you know, $75,000 in household income, or perhaps 75,000 pounds in annual household income, that is actually cheaper per thousand to reach those viewers than similarly situated white viewers. And so what that means is that the networks and channels are in some ways disinvested in reaching this audience, because there is more money to be made not reaching them. So when we talk about Black cast television, partly, it is about sort of the visuality of Blackness that will at the same time do what I've, in other essays and other work, I've called must-see Blackness, the idea that Black folks are in many ways predisposed to consume Black cast content because it is rooted in this idea of being seen in seen in and by media. So at the same time that these audiences are being partly hailed by the visual, at the same time these networks are actually thinking about how they can use Blackness to build an audience that advertisers will say, oh yes, like this is a thing. And then what happens, as we saw with networks like Fox in 1994, Fox had the critical mass and Fox had the money, more importantly, had the money to be able to buy the rights to a broadcast Sunday night NFL football. And as soon as they actually were able to collect that kind of capital on the backs of Black viewers, and I would also argue mostly young adult white males who were interested in hip hop and hip hop culture, once they could do that and buy those rights, they immediately pivoted. And so in 1993, for instance, Fox had the largest number of Black cast and Black produced television that has ever been on television. And then all of a sudden, by 1996, there were two Black cast shows. I think there was Living Single and I believe Martin were the two that were left. And so so part of it is this sort of history of a precarity. So it goes back at least until 1978, where I talk about, in another essay, I talk about The Wiz and its precarious nature within the media industries. So part of it is about the idea that Blackness and Black audiences in particular are never actually centered in terms of like, we really want to reach Black viewers and we really want to engage with Black viewers. And so there is an innate precariousness because we don't quite know how long this cycle of engagement with Blackness will last. And so that's part of what feeds the idea of precarity, which shapes the ways that the writer's room is functioning, because what people want to do in the writer's room is they want to maintain fairly consistent ratings so that they don't actually give the network a reason to cancel the show. And so the generic closet in some ways becomes a way to circumvent that kind of precarity, in the sense that what it does is it upholds these ideas and ideals about Blackness and Black audiences at the same time that it hails queerness for an episode or two that ultimately demonstrates the liberal nature of the cast who we're left to hang out with on a weekly basis.
It's probably worth saying a bit about what kind of representations come through from this system, because you mentioned the kind of three-act nature, which I think was a really interesting and useful framework for understanding this, because it's not that, you know, any of the sitcoms, so, you know, use, I think, Moesha, Stay Together, and Are We There Yet? As some core examples, but, you know, they're not kind of like outright homophobic in terms of what we'd recognize as being, you know, kind of hugely offensive representations. And indeed, that would probably have implications in terms of, you know, advertisers or, you know, community boycotts and stuff like this. But actually, you know, what is represented, you mentioned, you know, the affirmation of a kind of liberal, tolerant, good guys characters as the kind of core cast members. But what's represented is I guess quite a narrow version of what it is to be a Black gay man. And it'd be good to maybe hear a couple of examples of that and I suppose like why this is a problem.
Mm-hmm. So on one hand, these representations in Moesha, in Good News, in All of Us, in Let's Say Together, in Are We There Yet? Are, right, as you point out rightly, are not by any stretch of the imagination are necessarily, you know, offensive or what we might call stereotypical. And so this is actually really important, because as we sort of, and what is interesting and important about thinking about television in the 90s is that what it partly does is it picks up on what television is doing in the 1970s in the turn to relevance in American television, with programming like All in the Family, programming like Good Times, where they are trying to, on one hand, discuss these ideas about race, gender, sexuality, and class. But at the same time, if we're talking about gayness in particular, there is an effort to decouple gayness from what we might call a gender inversion kind of theory, wherein gay men are understood to be more feminine, and of course we use these words in air quotes, and lesbians are understood to be more masculine. And so what these representations then do is they very much are, you know, it's almost as if we're seeing, you know, a Black version of Will Truman from Will and Grace. So they're very quote unquote respectable as a general rule. They broadly construed don't hew toward any of the kinds of things that we have been told are negative stereotypes, whatever a negative stereotype is. And so the advocacy work of places like BLAD had been really effective in structuring how these representations could play themselves out. And so with the exception of Moesha, which is the first case study that I talk about in the book, there are no quote-unquote feminine gay characters. And what I found out in my research on Moesha is not only did the writer of the episode protest the idea of including this character, because it was a character that was written by the showrunner overnight after he had already turned in the script. But the showrunner actually justifies that character because he says, like, we are basically attempting to show a spectrum of Black gay sexuality. And so as the writer sort of read it as offensive, the showrunner, who of course gets to call the shots ultimately, reads it as this thing where it's like, well, we're showing a spectrum. And he also says, there's no way we would have had this more feminine character on the show if we didn't have the counterpoint. Because he says, I believe the quote is something like, nobody wants to offend anybody. And so there's very much these logics that continue to play out. And as you mentioned, like this way of trying to avoid community outrage.
You mentioned the writers. I'm glad you brought the writers up. I was intrigued by the way that that the writers on the one hand had, you know, kind of little or no sort of creative control, really, you know, even though they're, you know, kind of producing the sitcom, but at the same time, you know, we're desperately trying to kind of, you know, play around with the form and to kind of push boundaries. And yet the product was, as you said, I mean, the word respectable does so much kind of work in what you've alluded to, and, you know, kind of people who not just engage with sitcoms, but, you know, are kind of thinking critically about these issues will know exactly the point you're making. And I wonder if maybe I'll phrase the question as something like, you know, to what extent are the writers responsible, or to what extent, you know, do the writers have any kind of agency in producing these kind of narrow, respectable versions of Black gayness? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think they partly have some agency, but the nature of the writers' rooms are that generally the room is doing the writing. It is just that someone sort of gets designated as the head writer. So oftentimes, with the exception of the Labels episode, and I would also add the Good News episode, and that's because it was the pilot episode. But otherwise, the writers are talking about partly sort of coming up with the idea, and at the very least, they're figuring out the story or the broad beats of the story while they're still in the room. So part of it is that their name goes on it, and in some ways they absolutely have written it, but there is a way that the other writers can sort of throw in ideas, that the showrunner can say, listen, like, that's not what we're doing, like, we're going to do it this way. And so with Moesha, for example, the showrunner ultimately you know, pulls rank and says, I'm the showrunner, this is my show, and this is how we're going to do it. Don't care. And so there is, in some ways, some agency, because of course, like, you can, as a writer, you can take your toys and you can go home. At the same time, you are probably still going to have your name on the episode because, you know, you wrote it. And so there is a kind of carefulness because there is, one, people want to maintain employment, but also there is a way that they are very careful about being offensive. And when we say being offensive, I think partly they're afraid of being offensive in the eyes of organizations like GLAAD and watchdog groups like that. So they partly certainly do have some semblance of agency, but it is absolutely circumscribed agency, and they're always beholden to someone else.
Yeah, whether that's, as you say, kind of, you know, community representation, or whether it's the assumptions of what a potential Black audience wants or is comfortable with, or, you know, will sort of put up with, or almost. And this, I suppose, you kind of slightly take apart at the end of the book. When you get into the audience research, but another element of the audience is this aspect of laughter, and it's funny in a way that, you know, talking through the kind of the political economy, the industrial production of comedy can often mean that we don't actually talk about, are things funny, you know, are people laughing, you know, and again, you've kind of gestured towards the issue about, you know, well, how do we create things that are on the one hand funny, but also, you know, are not offensive in a variety of different ways to different communities. And I guess laughter is a really important element, partially because it's something that ends up kind of being part of the constraints on representation, but it's also something that is to do with, you mentioned this already, how the black cast sitcom is actually produced, you know, the kind of the physical infrastructure of the set and the things like the laugh track, or to a lesser extent kind of laughter from an audience. So I wonder if you could talk me through the kind of, this sounds like a really bizarre question, but the kind of function of laughter in the black cast sitcom and what that means for representations of black people.
So I was initially really very interested in thinking about the laugh track, because the laugh track has been sort of understood as being so integral to the sitcom as a form. And then as I was sort of doing my own research, I found like this tiny little passage in a book that suggested that in the 1970s, there was the development of what is considered a black laugh track, which is not only just the laughter, but it's particular kinds of reactions. So oohs, ahs, and so on and so forth, that have a kind of, in a stereotypic way, of course, a black cadence that we can understand. And so I was interested in thinking about this corpus of sitcoms and thinking through the laugh track, particularly because two of them are our traditional model of sitcoms, where it's, you know, we're shot in front of a live studio audience. And then three of them are shot in front of a live studio audience, but two of them are actually shot on a soundstage. And that was the thing that was really got me really thinking about this, is because what that means is that they're adding the laugh track entirely in post-production. So there is, you know, some person who is sitting there watching the footage along with either the showrunner or the episode writer, and they are actually deciding where laughter goes, how big the laugh is, how small the laugh is, if there's a reaction, and so on and so forth. And then also to even think back to something like Moesha, which is shot live in front of a studio audience. In one of my first interviews with the writer, he talked about how big the laugh was when this kind of stereotypic character comes through. And so I wanted to really examine sort of what is the work of the laugh track, because on one hand we think of it as like, oh, people are just laughing, and I wanted to think of it as an ideological tool, and also because of these shows that are shot entirely on a soundstage, I also wanted to think through, well, like, if we are actually hearing the laughter in a sort of shot in front of a live studio audience series, does that actually mean that's where the laughter was and where it was not? And like, could the laugh track be sweetened? And so in thinking about that, I wanted to think about where were the laughs in these episodes. And what generally shook out is that there was a way in which the laughter was always centered around the idea of queerness. And oftentimes what happened is that jokes about queerness were often told while the queer character was not in the scene. So it was sort of in some ways understood as this kind of safe space to laugh at this kind of humor. And even, let's also be clear, most of these roles, if not all of these roles, were played by heterosexual men playing a gay character. But there is a way in which sort of the removal of those characters from the scenes where the majority of the laughs take place is really fascinating. And also the way that even when there is laughter, when the Black gay characters are in these scenes, the laughter is sort of after the, often after the heterosexual characters' speaking parts, rather than necessarily allowing the Black gay characters to be the folks who are generating laughs through perhaps saying something clever or some other such thing that might be otherwise funny. So there is, in the laugh track, there's a way that the laugh track functions to decenter the Black queer experience, even as these series, these episodes rather, are ostensibly supposed to be about their queerness.
Yeah, as you've mentioned, you know, it's the recurring characters, almost all of whom have, particular kinds of heteronormative attachments in a variety of different ways that are, you know, the good guys, you know. And partially, this is something that, you know, we see a lot, and it's funny, you mentioned that kind of 70s style Tonight on a very special episode approach to these questions of representation. But also at the same time, it might lead us to forget that, you know, there is an audience who is supposed to be represented by these characters. And the book closes with a consideration of that, by going out and like literally talking to that audience. And it was really fascinating. I guess I sort of got a sense of the ambivalence of the representations that run through the Black cast sitcoms that you've analyzed, and to an extent an ambivalence about the representations that came from the men that you interviewed about these Black cast sitcoms. And I'm interested, I guess, in two things. You know, one is that, so what did they think? But also, what was the element of kind of possibilities for change? You might correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't get a sense of a kind of, you know, a great demand that, you know, the Black cast sitcom had like catastrophically failed this community, and you know, there was a real kind of burning sense of injustice, but more a kind of a sense of they need to do better.
Yes. Yeah. So it was a sense of they need to do better, but you know, at the same time, you know, one of the things that really, you know, shined through for me in thinking about these interviews was that so many of the men felt a kind of remove from these representations, primarily because they understood that these representations were not for them. And so they understood that, yes, in some ways it was about Black gayness, but it wasn't actually for them. And so there was a way that they watched it with a kind of ambivalence, because they were like, listen, perhaps somebody is enjoying this. I'm not the target demo for this. And so I feel like that was one of the things that was so extraordinary about these interviews, is this idea that there was a parsing, in some ways, a parsing of audience that the industry wasn't doing. And the industry, I would argue, in many ways has not done, even contemporarily, that these men were doing and saying, this isn't the type of show that I might watch to see myself reflected back. And instead, what they were saying is, let me back up. Let me say this. One part of it is that they were simultaneously very much like, I don't understand why this is the end of the story. And so part of what is interesting about, to go back to the writer's room and then come back to reception, is that in the writer's room, there is this sense that the part of why the generic closet functions narratively is because coming out as gay is the thing. And so these men, when they're watching these shows, they understand coming out as a beginning, i.e., like one comes out and then starts their life in some ways as a Black queer subject. And for the sitcom, coming out just produces information. And then, like, that's the end of the story. So on one hand, the Black gay men are like, oh, okay, so, like, I assume that there's a couple of other episodes in which this character just shows up and he's just, like, hanging out and, like, we know that he's gay. And within the writer's room, they're saying, well, I mean, we've done the gay story. Like, if the gay, like, if we aren't doing coming out, what's the gay story? And so there is that kind of disconnect, even in their ambivalence, there's this disconnect to sort of, to understand why this is the gay story. And partly that is why they understand these programs as not being for them. And then in some ways, they also don't necessarily have hope for the Black cast sitcom. Instead, what they have hope for is other genres. And so when I ask them to talk about programs that that they think do it right, or like what they would do to fix it, to fix representation, if representation is even fixable, they talk about other genres. So they talk about drama. They talk about even sort of the melodrama and the ways that those kinds of spaces tell different kinds of stories that engage perhaps queerness broadly construed or Black queerness specifically. So in some ways, they're really partly ready to kind of throw away the Black cast sitcom in terms of the way that it will engage with Black queerness specifically.
You mentioned drama, other genres, and I'm interested to know, is that kind of what your next set of projects is going to be about? One of the problems, I suppose, about writing a book like The Generic Closet is that, you know, you sort of reach a point with the text where you say, well, you know, what more can be done if we have a system that, you know, in some ways is perfectly set up to produce these narrow and, you know, problematic but not too problematic representations. And I'm interested to know, are you going to find something for a next project around comedy and the sitcom? Are you going to be looking at drama? Are you going to be doing something that's, you know, kind of completely different in terms of future work?
So yes and no is the answer. So my next project is partly sort of pulling in some ways at some of the strings in the last chapter on reception, and is doing sort of a full-fledged study of Blackness and Black fandoms. So that is sort of part of where the next project is going. And then there's also in the conclusion where I talk about the Black cast melodrama and talk about things like Empire and the haves and the have-nots as programs that have these longer engagements with Black gayness. I am going to be writing an essay for an edited collection that sort of talks about what does the Black queer life look like beyond The Generic Closet? And so what does melodrama offer us, and why does melodrama offer it to us? So in other words, I'm interested in sort of why this parsing all of a sudden of what we might understand as Black women as an audience. And part of it is the Shonda Rhimes effect. And also the Nielsen's, I believe, starting in 2011, started to really pay attention to Black women and their spending power. And so there is a way in which, because again, we rely in part on stereotype, there is a way in which we believe that Black women have a closer, perhaps less antagonistic, whatever you want to call it, relationship with gay men, and particularly Black gay men, so that the melodrama can actually be this space where that kind of work might be able to happen. And so I think what's interesting about it is that we partly think about the sitcom broadly construed as this way that we can talk about difference because we get to sort of laugh it off. And laughter gives us that pressure valve for these quote-unquote hot topic issues. But it's interesting to me that the melodrama is sort of doing that work for Blackness. And we could also argue that broadly construed, the melodrama has done a lot of work, or the soap has done a lot of work in terms of sexual representation throughout television history. But I think that's partly where my next project is gonna head.
Sounds like you need a full book on it, not just an essay.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I write an essay and then it's like, oh, there's more. And then I'm like, okay, fine, I'll write a book about it.
Look forward to reading it.